opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Estás escuchando a KUCI 88.9.
Vous écoutez KUCI.
Vous écoutez la radio KUCI 88.9 FM.
You're listening to 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine.
Heaven sends a song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you.
And welcome to Writers on Writing here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Deborah Keith, filling in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett this afternoon. I'm so excited. Next up is Heidi Julewitz with her book, The Uses of Enchantment. And then in the other part of the hour, we have Anne Martin waiting to give us all kinds of yummy advice. She is multi-million, a best-selling author. Just incredible things this hour. Stay tuned.
I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything
And welcome back to Writers on Writing here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm back with Heidi Julewitz. Her latest is The Uses of Enchantment. And Heidi is the author of two other novels, The Mineral Palace and The Effect of Living Backwards, as well as a collaborative book, Hotel Andromeda, with the artist Jenny Gage. She is a founding editor of The Believer, and she lives in Manhattan and Maine. Welcome, Heidi. How are you this evening? Welcome. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Oh, I'm excited to talk to you.
An
intriguing, complex book. First off, I just want to ask you how this came to be. I mean, this is a fascinating story, a really interesting character, which we're going to talk about, Mary.
Yes.
And so many dynamics. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think the thing that originally inspired me, in fact, was the Elizabeth Smart case.
Mm-hmm.
And for those who don't remember, this is a young girl who disappeared and for quite some time. And then it seemed to me around that time that suddenly there were upper middle class white girls disappearing every time you turned around. And so it suddenly occurred to me, like, wow, this seems like it's the cultural moment for a young, maybe slightly attention-starved, upper-middle-class white girl to fake her disappearance.
Mm-hmm.
So that was essentially my kind of plot hook. And you know, of course, because novels take so long to write, by the time I had finished this book, in fact, a girl had faked her disappearance. Yeah.
Predicting history.
You know, if you have a sort of premonition, a cultural premonition, no doubt it will have played itself out by the time you actually publish your book.
Well, give us a little more of a teaser about the book. So the listeners here on Writers on Writing get to know a little bit more about The Uses of Enchantment.
Well, essentially it is about a young girl who, at first you're not sure if she has or has not faked her disappearance, but it comes fairly clear that she has.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially then there is all this fallout from this disappearance. She reappears and claims to not remember what happened to her. She goes to a therapist, and this therapist very quickly starts to kind of interpret what happened to her, and then his interpretation becomes, in fact, kind of the authoritative story of what happened to her. And he publishes a book that becomes very well known, and she becomes this kind of infamous character, and she's a sort of famous case study. And then another therapist comes along and challenges this therapist's version, and then, of course, the mother of the disappeared girl also has her version of what she thinks happens. So essentially there are all these kind of competing versions of this girl's past. And she is never able to actually take control of her own past and say, no, this is what happened. You know, once all these threads kind of get into play, she suddenly has like guilt toward her mother or a sense of responsibility toward the therapist, and she can never just say, no, this is what really happened to me.
Heidi, these are fascinating characters, and the premise is just amazingly complex and interesting. You know, it's enticing. I want your advice on drawing characters and putting them together, because you have a lot of duality. Well, there's so much duality. I mean, every character is so deep and complex. There's a dark and light side, and so many of them have, you know, this dynamic to them, and that's hard to pull off in a novel, and you've done it brilliantly. So,
well, it's very nice of you to say. I mean, you know, it definitely is a goal of mine to not necessarily to not have sympathetic characters. I mean, I want everybody to be sympathetic. Part of what sometimes not annoys me about books, but can sometimes frustrate me about books, is if somebody's too obviously sympathetic and then somebody is too obviously the bad guy. You know, everything seems a little black and white. And it does seem to me in every situation that depending on who you are in that situation, you can be the sympathetic character. I think everybody thinks their own plight is the sympathetic position to have, you know? So in each of the sections, the book is actually told in three different sections. I want to keep kind of flipping the power dynamics in each section, so that at first you think, ah, the girl has been abducted by this abductor. And then you think, oh no, the abductor has actually kind of been abducted by the girl. And you keep sort of cycling around, like, who is the victim, who is the victimizer, and those roles continually change throughout the book.
Fascinating. Now, your book, The Uses of Enchantment, has been called a psychotherapeutic thriller. What does that mean?
I couldn't have said it better myself. Yeah, I mean,
do tell.
You know, I think one of the things as a writer that I try to do is I really try to write the kind of book that I would like to read. Mm-hmm. And if you said it's a psychotherapeutic thriller to me, well, I would run right out and buy it. So,
well, this could be a new genre. I mean, this is fascinating. And,
yeah. I mean, in a way, though, it's sort of interesting when you write. And I did read a lot of psychoanalysis, and then actually, you know, not only did psychoanalysis interests me, but in fact the cult of psychoanalysis and the strange kind of petty culture, I think, that has grown around this study of the human mind. I mean, the players involved are all very fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to read it, it does seem as though, I mean, every therapy session in a way is a kind of template for a thriller, you know? It's like you're trying to find something out. Mm-hmm. It's really just, it's so naturally this kind of exciting narrative in a way.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, I'm looking at an article.
And then you can have an exciting narrative all of your own, you know?
Oh, yeah, I've done therapy. Everyone I know has done therapy.
I know. And see, what usually happens is you find out, I mean, I've been to therapy, too, and I sort of realized that I was actually too dull to inspire my own interesting narrative, so I had to go make one.
Oh, I don't think so. Yeah. I'm looking at a picture of you, Heidi. You're a beautiful girl. And, and looking at this article that calls your writing psychotherapy. Therapeutic thriller. Mm-hmm. And it also ends with a question about an unreliable story. It sounds like a familiar subject to you, the interviewee for this article said, the unreliable story. And I guess that you have two books previously that you wrote that have similar themes. Tell us about that, about the
Definitely
unreliable story.
In the second book. The second book is a sort of blackly comic hijacking novel, which essentially there are two sisters and they are on an airplane and they're on the way to one of the sisters' weddings. One of them is getting married to a Moroccan prince. Mm. And en route, the plane is hijacked. And the sisters end up sort of, they've always had this very competitive relationship, and one of them ends up siding in a kind of Stockholm-y syndrome way with the hijacker, and the other sister ends up working for the hostage negotiator.
Ooh.
And anyways, but it soon... everything kind of gets turned upside down, and you're not sure, again, like, who is actually the hijacker, and is the hijacker, in fact, an anti-terrorist who's working in this sort of covert, weird way? Is it a training session for other anti-terrorists? Anyway, so it's...
Ooh, deep! Very sexy,
again,
too.
It was the sort of first time that I dipped into this territory, which has interested me for a long time, about therapy, and just this notion, I guess, that... You know, we don't really have a cultural mode of oral storytelling anymore, and therapy has become for us that mode of oral storytelling, and we are the kind of mythic heroes of the stories that we tell, and we frequently tell them just to this one other person, you know, and it stays in one room, and it never gets out, and so there's a strange kind of hermetic quality, I guess, to these stories now that used to be told, you know, around the campfire, and were part of the culture, et cetera. So this book also sort of plays around with that idea.
That's very powerful. I like that. Oh. You know, I want to read some reviews of your book because they're fabulous.
Yes.
Pulitzer Prize winning author, Michael, is it Chabon?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He said, an act of storytelling bravado, deadly smart, as shadowed with sex, violence, and deceit as the incident that it portrays. Dark and light, clever and profound, artful and effortless. The novel never stops feeling dangerous, not only to the lies we tell ourselves about girls' erotic lives, but to the easier truths as well. Julewicz is a wicked prose stylist, and this is her best book yet. And from Publishers Weekly, they say, beautifully executed, the mystery of what happened to Mary Vale will enthrall the reader to the very last page. That is good stuff. And I mean, it goes on and on and on. I want to ask you about what it was like writing your third book versus the first one, because now you're a seasoned pro.
Yeah.
What have you learned?
Well, unfortunately for me, every time I write a book, and even though this was my third book, I don't seem to have improved upon this method, which is I have to write a book in order and throw it away in order to write a book. So for every book that I have written, there is another novel that I wrote before it that had to get junked.
Oh, bless you, Heidi. Oh, that's so great. So many novelists out there are just going, amen, sister. That's good stuff.
And in a way, this one was the easiest pre-novel to throw away because, you know, essentially I had a very good friend. You know, everyone should have their trusted reader out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, someone asked me recently, well, how did you choose your reader? Is it somebody who writes the same way you do? Because she is also a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, no, you know, it's she reads the same way I do. We always like the same books. So that seemed to me, you know, how she writes is really immaterial. She read it, and I had just had my first, actually, I only have one kid. I had had my my daughter, and she was 4 months old. And basically, this friend got back to me and just, in a very polite way, sort of said that it was just absolutely dreadful, horrendous, unsavable, unsalvageable, rather, mess. And in a way, it made it, because I was so tired, I was just so tired, I was so strung out, I had this four-month-old kid,
mm-hmm.
I realized that it actually was going to be much easier to just throw this thing away
mm-hmm.
and start all over again than it was going to be to try to revive this thing, you know?
Mm.
So in a way, that was one of those moments where utter exhaustion served me well, you know?
Ah, that's good. And
yeah,
you listen to
so
the...
Everyone should, this is great writing advice. Go out, have a baby, you know?
Mm-hmm.
When you're at the absolute nadir of your life, then have your friend tell you that your book sucks and should be thrown away.
Well, but I mean, she probably saved you a lot of time.
She did.
Humbleness.
I talk all the time when I teach occasionally, and I always speak of her as, you know, it's like you need to, as much as you need to be gentle with people, and obviously all criticism should be constructive, you also do have to have the guts sometimes to really try to, you know, to help people come to the best decision for them, which sometimes is like throw it away, you
mm-hmm.
know, take the ideas that are working and just like start again, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's very brave.
Yeah.
Again,
it's not a fun thing to do. Either not to be the deliverer of that news is not fun, and to be the receiver of that news is not
mm-hmm,
fun, you know?
Mm-hmm. And it's so hard because you are really emotionally, spiritually, I mean, time attached to the work, and it's... You have to disattach at so many levels.
Funny. I mean, I do know so many people who have thrown their novels away. I mean, obviously, you know, every writer out there probably has thrown a novel away, at least one, if not, you know, many.
Mm-hmm.
And though the moment before you throw it away is the worst moment of your life, after you throw it away, you're just like, I feel great, you know.
Oh. Good advice. Thank you for sharing that. And again, I want to remind our listeners that this is Writers on Writing. I'm Deborah Keith. I'm filling in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett today. She'll be back next week. And of course, you can go to her website, penonfire.com, find out more about what's happening in Barbara's world and about upcoming guests and podcasts and just all kinds of wonderful things that are happening. And today we are talking to Heidi Julewitz. She's the author of The Uses of Enchantment. This is her third book. It's got rave reviews here. It's absolutely fascinating, and she's spilling her secrets live on air. Okay, Heidi, tell us about the writer's life and when you knew you wanted to be a writer.
Well, I was, I think, one of those dorky kids who always wanted to be a writer, and I did write a novel when I was in sixth grade, which has since gone missing, and I'm sure were it to be rediscovered would prove me to be, you know, a genius at a young age. What happened to that genius, I can't say, but, you know. It was a sort of adventure novel involving...
Uh-huh.
Brothers and sisters on a sailboat and an evil queen and very Narnia inspired. I've always wanted to be a writer, and I guess what's interesting is when you finally decide you're going to be a writer. And for me, I guess the moment that I decided to be a writer was the moment that I quit my day job, so to speak, and got a waitressing job, you know?
To pursue the artistic
life. Not to speak ill of waitressing, because I actually think, you know, if I had to go back,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would and get, you know, and earn regular money. I think that's the best way to do it
mm-hmm.
if you want to keep writing.
Oh,
but,
yeah. And you get to listen to witty dialogue all the time.
Exactly,
observe people.
Exactly.
And be
you
out
get
there.
Sort of spy on people getting engaged, you know, and give them little signals like, don't do it, you know.
Oh, gosh.
She's not worthy of you. It made me, because waitressing was not the kind of how should I say it? It wasn't the kind of job that I could just sort of rest on my laurels at the end of the day. You know,
mm-hmm.
you could say, oh, well, you know, I did go to my law firm today, you know.
Right.
And so even though I should go home and do a little writing, I'm actually a little tired and I'll do it tomorrow, you know.
Right.
But when you're a waitress, if you don't write every day, then you are just a waitress on that day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a good way that it kind of gives you that essential kick to work every day, and even those days that you don't want to. So
mm-hmm.
I think that was the point where I was like, okay, now I'm a writer, you know.
That's inspiring.
A waitress writer.
Uh-huh. Very good. I like that. You know, there's a lot of, I know, applause that we can't hear, you know, for those listening on the internet and live and, you know, really hearing what you're saying, and it's resonating. Okay. I want to know more about the parallels and how you create parallels and this wonderful irony that just is magnificent in your books. You've got these dualistic characters. I was really transfixed by Mary's mother, you know, which we see in different stages of life. And I won't reveal all those.
Yeah.
But she is this wonderful defensive person in one way, and then a horrible mother and has a lack of defense and concern in other ways. And how do we keep all these balls in the air and keep a story interesting and powerful and engaging and yet deep? And
yeah, well, you know, I think one of the ways also when you're, or at least when I am, you know, I think even though I did actually go and get an MFA in creative writing, so I did get a graduate degree
mm-hmm.
in writing, in so many ways, we are always self-taught if you're a writer, and
mm-hmm.
you self-teach through reading other books. And actually, you know, when I read a book, I often will see it as it's a template, you know. I mean, it really
mm-hmm.
is a template in terms of, and that you can borrow. And
right.
the template that I very much borrowed for this book came from a book by Tim O'Brien called In the Lake of the Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just an amazing book, which is also told in three different segments. And it alternates between the three segments. And you are instantly pulled into this book because this man may or may not have murdered his wife, you
mm-hmm.
know? And so you start just turning the pages and turning the pages and turning the pages because you're so desperate to find out. It has this totally addictive thriller-like quality to it.
Mm.
And you want to find out, like, oh my gosh, did he kill his wife? Did he not kill
right.
his wife? And then as you suddenly you start to like turn the pages a little slower because you start to get like, okay, the more information that he gives me, I'm realizing the further away I'm, you know, like the more information you get about this character and his wife and his situation,
mm-hmm.
the less certain you're becoming. You know, at first
brilliant, yeah.
killed his wife, you know.
Mm.
And then as you read more, it's almost like the information, I kind of compare it to, there's that famous movie by Antonioni called Blow Up, you know, where there's a photographer and he thinks he sees a corpse in a field, and he's taken a picture of this field, and there's a corpse, he thinks, in the back. And so he blows it up and blows it up and blows it up so he can see if there's actually a dead person back there.
Mm-hmm.
And the closer he gets, or the bigger the photograph gets, suddenly there's a moment where it becomes clearer, and then it just starts to completely fray, you know? And so it's that kind of moment where you're like, oh, you know, and I love that. I love that. I love that kind of, that, you know, duality is a really great word for it. I feel like there are a lot of character dualities in this book, but
mm-hmm.
then there's also the duality of this kind of hungry, addictive, thriller-like plot that
mm-hmm.
then ends up being something where you're like, oh, you know, it makes you ask. You realize that you're actually the person who's going to have to make some decisions yourself. You know,
mm-hmm.
you're not just going to be handed the answer to this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're going to say, oh, okay, I've been given all this information, and now I kind of have to decide, what do I think? You know,
right, right. Well, the reader, yeah, it has to pay close attention, and they really are participating in a psychological way in your writings. So that's good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is a way that I, you know, another kind of template that I feel that I've stolen, or, you know, in terms of an ending template, there's a movie by Todd Haynes called Safe, which if people haven't seen it, they should absolutely see it. It's a fantastic movie. It's Julianne Moore's first kind of Stepford housewife role.
Ooh, I like it.
She went on to, you know, perfect this role. This is the first time. And she's this housewife in L.A., and she seems to have this environmental allergy. She's allergic to her husband. She's allergic to her house. It gets more and more and more severe, you know? And you're never really quite sure, like, do you really believe she has an environmental allergy? Like, is it physical or is it mental or does it matter, you know? And then at the end, there's this great moment where she's gone to this crazy sort of healing environmental guru's ranch out in New Mexico or something, and she's living in this hermetically sealed environmental proof igloo, you know? And she looks at herself in the mirror, and you think, ah, finally, she's taken control of her life. She's saved herself. And then you think, no, in fact, she's totally screwed, you know? And then you just keep going back and forth between she's saved, she's not saved, she's saved, she's not saved. And I love that. I love that kind of tension.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Great, great analysis. Thank you for that. Heidi, you are the founding editor of The Believer.
Yes.
What is that? And tell us about that experience.
Yes. Well, The Believer is a monthly magazine. It originally started as a book review, but it is now more kind of a culture magazine. We do everything from book reviews. Actually, right now, the issue that's about to hit the stands, which I have to say is just the most fabulous issue I think we've ever done. We do a yearly visual issue. So this is an issue that's all about art. There's an interview, a really fantastic interview with Matthew Barney, a curator from Philadelphia, picked 10 women artists that she felt people should be more aware of. There's fantastic stuff in there. So it's not, obviously, it's not all about books, but we do sort of take as our foundation a kind of literary interest, I guess. And we started originally now, I guess, March 2003 was our first issue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's
great.
Been a couple of years, almost coming up on 4 years, which is so crazy to think. That's what doing a monthly magazine, you know, it makes your life go by all the faster because you're like, are you kidding? It's already we already have to pass in our articles for next month, you know?
Wow, well, that keeps you writing and busy and,
really fast.
Yeah, and on a schedule because sometimes that's nice to have a part of your life that's real scheduled because
yeah, it's nice, actually, you know,
it's
so
different.
First of the month, you know, everything's due, so anyway. So, but we did originally start the magazine as kind of a response to what myself and my co-editors, Vendela Vita and Ed Park, and then also Andrew Leland, saw as the book reviewing culture seemed to have kind of stagnated and then also seemed to be turning really kind of vicious. And it seemed more than, like, the novel itself didn't seem to be dead so much as the way we talked about the novel seemed to be dead and about literature in general. And, you know, a lot of this was because, I think, you know, so many venues that carried book reviews or published book reviews, the space afforded to book reviews had gotten smaller and smaller and was ever shrinking. And reviewers used to have, you know, a few pages to talk about a book. Now they had a half a column, you know. They had 250 words. Essentially, the most you could do is describe the book. And, you know, I mean, what I think you have to remember is that book reviews are pieces of writing, too, you know. Somebody wrote them.
Absolutely.
And if you're a writer, you want people to write what you've written. And I think given that amount of space, the easiest way to be paid attention to was to be really inflammatory and was to just sort of, you know, essentially the word that I use in my introductory essay is be really snarky. So we founded The Believer as what we saw as kind of an antidote to that.
That's wonderful.
I love
that.
All of our book review articles were, all of our essays, we bragged they were never under 4,000 words. You know, that was our Now they vary in length, and we also do short reviews now just because so few new books of fiction get reviewed, and especially not small press books. So we do try to give short reviews.
What a great contribution, Heidi.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's, you know, and it's just so exciting, I think, to, you know, what to me is so exciting about meeting other writers, which, you know, if you're a writer, you don't really meet a lot of other writers, quite frankly. Writers keep to themselves a lot of the time. It's not like you have a guild meeting or like a yearly conference in Miami or something, you know? And so, you know, and what I loved about meeting writers when I did meet them is just you always get you always are introduced to somebody else's reading passions when you meet another writer. And I love that. I loved getting shot off in a totally new reading direction when I would meet somebody new. Mm-hmm. And so I see The Believer hopefully functioning as something where you can pick it up every month and you will get shot off in a new reading direction. Like you'll get turned on to something that, you know, you might not have otherwise ever encountered.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm going to ask you in just a minute here some of your favorite pieces of advice and books that you would recommend to our listeners out there here on Writers on Writing. Want to remind our audience that I'm talking to Heidi Julevich. She's been sharing her wisdom and wit with us, and her latest book is The Uses of Enchantment, and she's also one of the founding editors of The Believer. She has two other wonderful books. So much good stuff coming from Heidi. I would like you to read for us, Heidi. Do you have a
Sure, I do.
Passage.
I can just read very quickly from...
Excellent.
This is from the very first section in the book, when the disappearance is a-brewing. Rain pattered over the grass as the girl traversed the empty field, her cleats suctioning in and out of the mud. She did not hurry. The man, she knew, would wait for her. Every afternoon, the man parked across the street from the cemetery where she and her friends escaped after lunch to smoke cigarettes. At first, they thought he was an undercover cop or a truant officer, someone hired by their headmaster, Miss Pym, to keep tabs on their forbidden roaming during school hours. But the man's car, a 1975 gray Mercedes, rendered this suspicion unlikely. He'd since been downgraded to probable pervert and treated by the girls as their mascot, rallying proof of their irresistibility. The girl made sure to pause each day in his line of vision to adjust her knee sock or swing her simmering issue skirt around so that the rear knife pleats snapped back and forth like a school of fish when she walked. She had noticed that as the weeks of fall progressed, as the trees became more and more naked and the humid tropical haze over the cemetery thinned to an astringent veneer, the man stopped watching in his non-watching way the anonymous passing of girls, and focused on one girl in particular. This should have been thrill enough.
Mm. Beautiful and mysterious. Thank you, Heidi. That's wonderful. All right. We just have a couple more minutes here. I've got Anne Martin up next, but I want to get any advice you have for writers out there who are listening and let you know you, know your work, think you're fabulous, and want to follow in your footsteps. Do you have any advice for them? And you can take a few minutes here, and then I want you to also contribute your ideas on writers that listeners should be looking at.
Sure, of course. I would say that, one thing I will say, I guess in a way I'm just going to repeat some things I've said already, but one would be, I do think sometimes when I'm teaching younger writers, I think they're writing something that they feel the need to express, mm-hmm. and this is all great. I think you need to have an emotional attachment to what you're writing. But I don't think that they are writing something that they themselves would read. Mm-hmm. And I do sort of compare it to an architect who builds a house that he himself would never consider living in.
good.
And I do think it's important to pay attention to what you like to read and why. And try to channel that reading passion that you have into what you write, and try to have some sort of connection between those two things, because I think that they are inextricably connected. And mm-hmm. if you're not reading, well, then that's a really big red flag.
Yeah, I have to agree there.
I mean, I do. It is a very remarkable thing. I actually was in an airport recently and ran into this man who was a lawyer. He introduced himself to me. I was working on my computer, so he wanted to ask me what I did, blah, blah, blah. And he, of course, said, oh, I've always wanted to be a writer, as so many people seem to want to be. And I said, oh, well, what do you read? Well, of course, and he says, I feel like I have all these novels in me. And then I ask him what he reads. Well, he doesn't read novels.
Oh.
He reads histories. He reads nonfiction. And I just was like, well, why do you want to write them? Who do you think are going to read them if you don't even read them?
Mm-hmm.
So I do think it's important to try to find the connection between your reading life and your writing life.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you know, I think depending on how much you want to put yourself on the line, and of course, you know, I was in my 20s when I decided, oh, I'm going to quit my job and start waitressing, you know, and I didn't
mm-hmm.
have kids, and I didn't have a car, and I didn't have a mortgage or anything. So, you know, it was an easy enough decision to make at that point. But there is a way, I think, that you can make writing a daily part of your life, and sometimes you have to really force yourself. I had to force myself. There are probably other people out there who are more motivated and don't have to trap themselves, you know.
Well, it's fun once it's going good, you know. But yeah, sometimes getting to the table, you know,
exactly.
Getting to the typewriter is a little hard.
Like put yourself in the most desperate situation possible and try to write yourself out of it, you know. But you know, the other thing too, I will say, after publishing three books, and I mean, it's been such a, you know, especially in this day and age, it's frankly, this sounds pathetic, but it is a privilege to publish three books, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is. I sort of feel like you're lucky if you get your first break, and then you're even luckier if you get your second break, and then your third and your fourth. It actually gets harder. I think it's easier to be a debut writer these days than it is to be somebody writing their fourth or fifth book, you know?
Mm, interesting.
Yeah, because you don't have a sales track record, and so they can sort of believe, oh, well, you might be the next blah, 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 you know?
Mm-hmm.
You might sell, you know, many millions of thousands of trillions of books.
Mm-hmm.
And if you actually have that sort of, you know, computer track record behind you, it's harder to fool themselves. And so I think it becomes harder to sell subsequent novels, which is a shame, because not a lot of people write their best novel the first time out, you know?
Great point.
Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, very few people do. That does happen. But anyways, but what I was going to say, though, is that I do, after the third time around, I think I finally realized that, you know, when you define success for yourself, it's almost really dangerous, I think, to rely too heavily on the moment of publication and what that's going to bring for you. And I actually have a writer friend who very aptly calls publication the calm before the calm.
Ooh.
And I do think that, you know, the moment when I feel most, I guess, successful, or when I feel the point in the book writing process that is the most rewarding for me, or brings me the most pleasure, is that moment when you really know what you're doing. You've already written that book and thrown it away and started up again, you know, and you just get up every day and it actually is almost as pleasurable as reading, you know, because you've got your parameters set up and you can just get up and do it every day.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just discovering, like, what's going to happen to these people today, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually the moment, like, when that's happening to you, just think, like, ah, all right, this is why I'm doing this.
Yep.
Is the best part of this whole thing right now, you know?
That's the joy and the journey. Well,
yeah.
Real quick, any recommended reading?
Well, yes. The book that I read this summer that just blew my mind is a book called Kensington Gardens by a writer, Rodrigo Frazan.
Ooh.
And he is actually an Argentinian writer who lives in Spain. He's very famous over there, but of course, you know, we tend to not translate a lot of books over here. So
mm-hmm.
he's finally been translated here. And it just was the perfect book to read. I mean, if you think we're sort of just after the J.T. Leroy scandal and the James Fry scandal and all these scandals that are bringing to ever more to the forefront this notion that fiction and nonfiction, like, there is no line anymore between these two. There are no genre boundaries any longer, let's just face it. Anyway, so this book is a novel, and it is, you know, in theory a novel about this guy who's the son of these 60s London rockers, you know?
Ah.
But in fact, it ends up being this sort of stealthy biography of J.M. Barrie, who is the author of Peter Pan.
Right.
And it also has all these amazing meditations on reading and children's books and writing and all the kind of stuff that, done by a less skilled person, you'd just be like, ugh, gag me. I don't want to hear about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the last thing I want to hear is someone writing about reading or writing or something. But if you are a reader or a writer, it's sort of, you know, you're just like underlining, like, yes.
Ooh.
I mean, those are the best books, when someone sort of articulates a feeling that you had, you know. You're like, yes, that's what it felt like to be me. Oh, wait,
ooh,
but you're not writing about me, you know.
Well, that sounds like a good one. I'm going to check it out. Well, Heidi, thank you so much for sharing your story and your book.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
Yes, and have a fabulous afternoon. And
I will. Evening, where I am.
Evening, that's right.
Yes.
Evening.
Yes. I'm going to go pop up some popcorn and
all right.
Download something on iTunes like every good writer should do, right?
There you go. Thanks so much, Heidi.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
And again, Heidi's book is The Uses of Enchantment, and this is her third, again, Heidi Julewitz. And next up, we've got Ann Martin. We're going to take a short break, play some good music for you. Barbara's got some great tunes here, so we're going to put those on. I'll be right back. I'm Deborah Keith, filling in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett. She'll be back next week. Again, this is Writers on Writing here on KUCI. Hang tight. Ann Martin's up next.
Darling, you say you want to write a book? Well, then you must listen to Writers on Writing, darling. Authors, literary agents gabbing and babbling about the art and the business of writing. Thursdays, 5 p.m. Darling, you must. Barbara DeMarco Barrett, she hosts. Yeah, listen, darling.
On KUCI FM in Irvine.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Deborah Keith, filling in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett this afternoon. And I'm so excited to introduce Ann Martin. Of course, her name's going to sound familiar to you, but I'm not going to give the secret away just yet. I want to tell you that her newest book is A Christmas Eve. It's a fantastic, whimsical tale about Christmas magic. And of course, Ann Martin has had books published by Scholastic Press, including Belle Teal, Here Today, and A Corner of the Universe. She is a winner of a Newbery Honor Award. Her acclaimed 2005 novel, A Dog's Life, The Autobiography of a Stray, was a BookSense bestseller, and she lives in upstate New York with a bunch of animals. And there's so many more wonderful things to say about Ann, but we're going to keep those secret and reveal them slowly as she spills her secrets and gives us some Christmas magic. Welcome, Ann.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm excited for you to tell us about your newest book on Christmas Eve. Let our listeners here on Writers on Writing know about how this book came to be and why it's so special.
Okay. Well, Christmas was always very, very special when I was growing up. My father especially made the holiday special for my sister and me. We did a lot of crafts. My dad would get out the wrapping paper and start
wrapping Christmas presents on Thanksgiving night. Right after we had finished Thanksgiving dinner, Dad would get out the wrapping paper. So it was really a wonderful holiday and very magical, and it still is that way for me. So I had wanted to write a Christmas story for a long time, and this is the story. It's set in the late 1950s when I would have been about 3 years old, and it's the story of Tess, who's actually 8 years old, who is a true believer in Santa Claus. She absolutely believes in Santa. She knows he exists. And this is the story of Tessa's meeting Santa Claus. That's no secret. She knows she's going to meet him. The real mystery comes about after she meets him, when she's asked Santa Claus not for something, but she's asked him to do something, and she's not sure he's going to be able to do it. And so the rest of the book after Tessa's meeting with Santa is really about the year after this Christmas Eve, in which her faith is tested a little bit, and her belief is shaken a bit. So
great synopsis. Now, it's a beautiful book, great gift book. And I know any age could appreciate it, but it is written for a juvenile audience, right?
Yeah, would say for about 7 to 10 or 12, maybe.
Okay. I know I'm going to share it with one of my kids, so I'm excited.
Okay.
And I want to mention to all the listeners here on Writers on Writing, I said Ann Martin is very famous, and you probably recognize the name, because she, of course, is the author of the very famous and very loved Babysitter's Club series. And you came to great acclaim and great fame with all of that. But a lot of listeners and people out there don't know what a well-rounded writer you are. I mean, you've done so many wonderful pieces and
Thank you.
So many books and with such a variety, literary books, books about animals, from an animal point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just so much. And just for 30 seconds a minute, could you tell us about that journey and about yourself as a writer?
Sure. I had started out writing novels for younger readers before the Babysitter's Club began, and I had continued to write other kinds of books while the series continued, but it wasn't until after the series ended, which was in 2000, that I really began writing, I guess, a slightly different kind of book, and writing a bit, not more seriously, but maybe more thoughtfully. And Belteal, A Corner of the Universe, Here Today, and On Christmas Eve were all books that were set in the 1960s and also the 1950s for On Christmas Eve. And that was really the most important, those are the most important years of my childhood. And I think that played into the shift that my writing took after the series books ended.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw you quoted saying you do take a lot of personal experiences and put them right into your book. So that's probably why they feel so natural. There's just a flow, a friendliness, an ease with your books.
And, thank you.
You're a very gifted writer.
Thank you.
You know, there's a lot of readers out there, a lot of listeners, a lot of fans. Do you have any tips for someone who wants to be you and who wants to follow in your footsteps?
Well, for kids, I have a couple of writing tips for kids, and then I have a couple of tips for adults who are more serious about actually being published.
Mm-hmm.
For kids, I always suggest, first of all, being a very wide and eclectic reader so that you become familiar with all different kinds of writing, fiction, nonfiction, poetry, journalism. I think if you're a more discerning reader, it helps you become a better writer.
Mm-hmm.
And another tip for kids especially, I mean, this applies to anybody, I think, but for kids especially, is to keep a journal. And that's mostly because the most common complaint I hear from kids who want to become writers is that they don't know what to write about, and a journal is a great source of material.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's good writing practice too, but I think it's even more importantly a source of story starters for
mm-hmm.
kids. And then for people who are really serious about becoming published, I have a lot of tips. One is to find out if there's a local chapter of SCBWI, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. That's a wonderful resource for anybody who's a beginning writer, whether you're published or not.
Those are great tips. Well, you know what? I'm looking more at your resume and profile, and something that really impressed me, Anne, was Horn Book Magazine praised your work and said, Martin excels at evoking simply the intricacies of friendship, what it enables you to give to others, and what it teaches you about yourself. I love that. And School Library Journal also raved, Martin delivers wonderfully real characters and an engrossing plot. Do you want to give any quick advice on how you do that so well?
I guess the first thing that I think about when I'm creating a character is the character's background. That's usually the starting place for me. When I can place the character in a setting and have some history for the character and be able to put myself inside the character's head and look out, that's the way I usually start to create a character. And the more details that you can come up with when you're creating a character, the better.
Mm-hmm.
Go way, way, way beyond what the character looks like and, you know, what her hobbies are. That's just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the most important thing for me, I think, when I'm creating a character. And when I'm starting any book, I usually also create, and this is all part of the outline. I do a lot of outlining when I start to write. I also write a certain amount about the setting, too, so that I have the setting in mind. That's almost as important as the characters, time and place.
Mm-hmm. Great points. Well, I want to remind our listeners, this is Writers on Writing. I'm Deborah Keith, filling in for Barbara DeMarco Barrett, who will be back next week. Check out Pen on Fire or Writers on Writing, and you can find out more about upcoming guests and podcasts and all kinds of great happenings. I'm talking to Anne Martin right now. She is the author of many, many books, very successful books, and a prolific writer. And she's going to be reading from her newest creation on Christmas Eve. And then at the very tip of the hour, I want you to tell us what's upcoming in your book life, because I know there's some exciting things. But please take us on a journey into Christmas Eve.
Okay. The selection I'm going to read is from the beginning of the book, not the very beginning, but close to it. It takes place when Tess, the narrator, takes a walk in the snow with her dog, Sadie.
Mm-hmm.
Bundle up, Mom calls from the kitchen. The snow is flying again. I bundle up until I feel like a pillow stuffed into its case. Then I call to Sadie, and we set out down our lane, fluffing our feet through the snow. When our lane meets the road, we turn left and walk by the Andersons' farm. Their house is even older than ours, built in 1756, and I am positive the Andersons share it with at least one ghost. Over the years, several people have died in the house, and Mrs. Anderson says that sometimes when she's in the kitchen, she can feel another presence in the room, even though no one else is at home. And Sadie will happily go into the Andersons' house, but she refuses to enter their kitchen. "Let's say hi to Peanut, Sadie," I say. Peanut is Evie's horse. Evie is Tess's older sister.
Mm.
Evie got Peanut on her 9th birthday, which was exactly 1 year after she turned horse crazy. She stables him at the Andersons. Sadie and I wander through the barn. I stop to pat Peanut on his nose. We call hello to the Andersons when we see them sweeping snow off their porch. Then we fluff across their yard and continue down the road. It is later, after we have turned around and are on our way home, that Santa Claus comes into my head again. Sadie and I are wrapped in this silvery light, the snowflakes whirling around us, no sound but the small howl of the wind. I am looking ahead, trying to see our house in the distance, and all of a sudden, I can't see anything at all. It is as if Sadie and I are inside a milky bubble. I stop, stand still as a statue, and, for just one teeny moment, I am in a room, a cozy room with a fireplace, a Christmas tree in one corner, and I hear two words in my head. I don't know who says them, but there they are, Santa Claus. And then, in another instant, Sadie and I are back in the snow, and I can see the barn, and in the distance, our house, smoke wisping out of the chimney. Did you see that? I ask Sadie. Did you hear that? Sadie looks up at me, then down at the snowy road again. Under all my warm clothes, I shiver. Santa Claus. It is a sign, I think. A sign that I am going to meet the real Santa this year. I know that Santa comes to our house every Christmas Eve, and I feel I have gone long enough without meeting him. For one thing, I need to talk to him. But also, it's actually a little rude letting him come into our home year after year and leave presents for us and never thanking him in person. I'm not sure I've ever even written him a thank you note, although I have thanked him in my heart many, many times. Santa, I will say, or maybe I should address him as Mr. Claus. Mr. Claus, I will say, no, too formal. Santa, it's me, Tess McAllister. Well, I suppose I don't have to tell him my name. Santa already knows who I am. Santa, I want to thank you for all the great gifts you have given me. That's how I think I'll begin. Then I will ask him my questions, and of course, I will watch the magic. I have always wondered how, exactly, Santa arrives and what the magic looks like. I realize Sadie has stopped walking. She's standing a few feet ahead, staring at me. I have the spooky feeling she knows what I'm thinking. Sadie, I start to say, but Sadie turns around then and heads up the lane to our house, so I follow her. That afternoon, I make the mistake of telling Evie my plan. That's where I'll stop.
Ah, wonderful. Thank you so much, Anne.
My pleasure.
And again, that's from On Christmas Eve by Anne Martin. She's a Newbery Honor-winning author, best-selling author of many books. And tell us what's next, Anne, and then any advice you want to give in just a couple minutes as we wrap up Writers on Writing.
Okay. What's coming up next, to my own surprise, is another series.
Ooh.
When I ended the Babysitter's Club, I said I would never, ever write another series again. And then my editor tempted me with the idea of writing about sewing because he knows how much I like to sew.
Mm-hmm.
So I started thinking about sewing and sewing stores and then towns with sewing stores in them. And before I knew it, I had created this whole world, the town of Camden Falls in Massachusetts, and all the stores on Main Street and the people who live in the town. So the series is called Main Street, and the first book will be out in May of next year, and it centers around four girls who meet in the first book and become fast friends, and it's stories about them and their lives and the lives of other people in the town and small town happenings, and I'm having a lot of fun with it.
Oh, I can't wait. It sounds good. Well, any last piece of advice?
Gosh, I don't know. That's a hard one. for people who want to write or be published or...
Who want to write. Who want to be successful and read like you, to have your kind of success. What's some advice?
Well, I think the most important thing for me is the characters. Plot is sometimes very difficult for me to come up with, but I usually concentrate on the characters. And for me, the better developed the characters are, the better the story is. And also, it's really just a lot of fun making up characters.
Mm-hmm. You got it. Great last words. Thank you so much, Anne.
My pleasure.
My pleasure, too. This has been Writers on Writing, and we're going to be signing off right now. And Anne Martin's been talking about her newest, On Christmas Eve. Be looking for that series, this premiering this summer, and so many other great, great novels written by Anne Martin and also Heidi Julewitz. Thanks for joining me, Deborah Keith. This Writers on Writing. I'm signing out. Have a great week.